History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that we ought to hear. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we sure do learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I'm in Fresno, California with a couple who just celebrated their 79th wedding anniversary. I know it sounds impossible, but we're going to hear the story. We'll start with the older of the two, Lewis Wagoner, 96 years old, of Fresno, California. But you grew up in a place that's become a little more famous the last few years, thanks to Hollywood. McFarland, California. McFarland, USA, a great film talking about their cross-country team. But that was a few decades after you came through that high school. What was it like growing up there in rural Kern County way back when?
Well, it was just, it was back the way it really should have been. I mean, we walked to school. Well, before, earlier we did the school bus, but then we finally moved to town. McFarland to town. I walked to grammar school, walked to high school, come home for lunch. You know, you had a lot of freedom. Back in those days, we didn't lock our doors or anything like that, so that's about the way it was.
Well, and you had a big family, a blended family. You had a few half-siblings and then eight siblings with the same parents. And I'm just imagining a big family like that in the Great Depression must have been fairly memorable. What do you remember about those years?
A lot of everybody had their chores. And of course, I was, as the oldest, my half-siblings were gone by that time. And so I milked the cow twice a day. And we had chickens and rabbits in the backyard, so we had something to eat. And things were tough. We made it all right.
You know, other than milking the cow in the morning and the evening, what kinds of things did you pass the time with back then? What did kids in the 1930s do for fun?
Well, we did all sorts of things. Climbed trees, hiked, went frogging with bow and arrow, and did the chores and kept busy with something.
Do you remember, I know it's a long time ago, but do you remember having some of those ideas that boys sometimes have? Hey, when I grow up, here are the things that I'm going to do with my life?
I had no idea. Absolutely not. In fact, I just stumbled on to getting where I finally made it in life. But from going to school in McFarland, I mean, I was a cotton picker before they made mechanical Okies. And I picked grapes, and, you know, we did that to help with the school clothes and something to eat. We made it. We made it through.
Well, and from what ages? How old do you think you were when you were out there picking cotton or grapes to help cover the family budget?
We started when I was about five. Mom and Dad had the regular cotton sacks, and I got a gunny sack with a deal, and I'd pick the cotton and put it on top of theirs, and they'd go weigh it. So we worked in the fields and whatever I could do.
Good thing it doesn't get hot in a Kern County summer, right?
Oh, no. It never gets hot. I mean, out there cutting grapes in September when it's 110 and... and fighting the wasps. So, yeah, that was the first one that came off. We would put the raisins down and fight the wasps, and then later on we'd pick the cotton. Whatever odd jobs we could do. And it wasn't easy. We didn't have a lot of money.
You say we didn't have a lot of money. Did that affect your degree of happiness or joy or fulfillment?
It just seemed like it was what we had to do.
And did you ever have any thoughts as that kid out there picking cotton and grapes and doing all those things? Do you have any thoughts of getting on a sailboat and racing?
Never a thought. I mean, sailboats or something like that were just funny. But most of the kids played baseball, and I didn't like baseball. So many times I'd sit out in left field for the whole game and never touch the ball. You know, that's no fun for me. I like something active. So I did more active things. The McFarland High School football team, or student body, was 150. And I was on the football team, third string. So I was really good.
Well, they just didn't have the sport that you would eventually excel at and win national championships in, sailing, but we'll hear about that. Normally, when I'm talking to World War II veterans, one of the first things I want to ask them about is about December 7th, 1941, and how they experienced that day, but there was a pretty significant day in your life that came a year and a half before that. In February of 1940, you got married. You were only 17 years old. And your bride was only 15. So I've got to hear the story of how you and Ruth met. What's that story?
Well, I was living there in McFarland on summer vacation. Not much to do, not much work. So I went down to San Bernardino, or Highland, actually, to visit some cousins. And he says, oh, I got to take you over and show you this cute gal, you know. Well, then he wished he hadn't. So anyway, it finally ended up that we got married there on February 22nd, 1940, and we've been at it ever since.
Yeah, 79 years and counting now. You're on your 80th year of marriage. But what possessed you at the time? 17 years old, you're in high school still, to quit high school, run away, and get married. And what did your parents have to say about it?
Well, they thought it was not too smart, but here we are. So that's the saga.
Well, I think we'll come back before we're done, and I'll give you some time to think about it. But I'm assuming after 79 years of marriage, you've learned a few things that you can share with the rest of us who aspire to that kind of longevity. So you're married now. What did you do to pay the bills and support this bride of yours?
Well, like I say, I did agricultural work, and one of the things I did, I drove a tractor pulling a harvester, just whatever we could get. Later on, because I knew how to milk cows, I worked at dairies down in San Bernardino, and finally I got burned out on that. The wars had started, so I went to the Navy Yard in Bear Island and told them I wanted a job. And they said, oh, what kind of a job you want? I said, anything. What do you got? So I spent almost the whole day in the personnel deal taking physicals and written exams. And it was my first experience with an aptitude test. And so about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they says, okay, you're a helper ship fitter. Show up at shop 11 at midnight tonight and go to work. And I said, what the heck is a ship fitter? But it was right down my alley.
So what the heck is a ship fitter? A lot of people today would have no idea.
Well, we lay out and fabricate steel structures, for it be built a lot of engine foundations for submarines. They were improving their engines, getting better, some deck houses. And after I became a ship fitter, I was a helper to start with. The Nassau, which was blown apart out in the Coral Sea, had a hole right through the, I don't know how, the bomb didn't explode inside the ship, but it went through both sides. So, and it didn't sink, so they closed off all the doors. So the hull strength job for that was what I did on my graveyard shift. I did that, and that turned out real good. So I got an advancement and just all sorts of things. But layout and fabrication of steel is what it is. I like working with steel.
You know what? Let me come back to all that, because I'm thinking I should probably get her side of the getting married story as well before I forget to come to her. So, Ruth, he told me that, you know, his cousin said, you got to come over and see this cute girl. What do you remember about this guy from McFarland who showed out there?
Well, that was his cousin. I remember he was a nice guy, and I think he kind of liked me, but Lewis interfered, and I fell in love with him, and that's the story.
15 years old.
Yep.
And he asked you to marry him?
Yes. Would you marry me? I think is what he said.
Did that sound like a crazy idea to you?
No. I didn't like school.
So what did your parents say?
They said, okay, but you're too young. But they agreed.
So where'd you have to go to get married?
Las Vegas.
You think that wedding chapel's still there?
I don't know, but I doubt it. That's a long time ago.
Was that a little scary or unknown to dive off into that kind of adventure together at such a young age?
No, my girlfriends got married about the same time as I did. Yeah, then we got married young, but not now.
Well, I'm guessing their marriages couldn't have lasted 79 years, right?
No, there's none of them alive. They're all gone.
Is it hard for you to believe it's been this long?
Yes, it's hard, and we have had a good life together. Our sailing was a highlight of our life, plus our three children. They are good children.
Do you remember your first impression of this guy?
I can kind of vaguely remember. He was very young, both were, but very handsome, and fell in love with him right away.
What about Pearl Harbor Day? Because here you're, like you said, you're working, you're trying to support a young wife. How'd you find out about what happened out there?
We were at a theater there, and it was a Sunday, so I got one day off from milking the cows, and we went to the theater, and they stopped the show and says, Pearl Harbor's been bombed, and shook everybody up. I don't know how to explain it any better.
And that was out in San Bernardino, or where?
Yeah.
So you've got a child already, and now, you know, there's a wife and a child to take care of. Was there a thought in your mind that now that America's at war, you might become part of it?
Well, yeah. I mean, back in those days, you were patriotic, and we tried to enlist, but they wouldn't take family men at that time. Yeah, we were, our country's at war. We're going to fight.
So right after Pearl Harbor, you went and tried to sign up?
Yeah, the next day, right away anyway. But they weren't taking family men, so did what we had to do. Then I went to work at the Navy Yard, and at 1944, I guess, they got to the point where they're taking married men, and got my draft notice and went to that part.
So up until that point, from 42 to 44, you're working there at Mare Island as a ship fitter, as you talked about. You told us about repairing the Nassau after it had been hit in action. Can you help us understand what the atmosphere was like back then as far as being in a war-related industry, being on the West Coast in a seaport that could be a target, and hearing the constant news of what was going on around the world?
Well, yeah, I mean, everybody was patriotic back in those days, not like today. Yeah, we all worked together, and that's how we were able to win the war. Yeah, we didn't have the attitude that's prevalent a lot today.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because so often we hear about, you know, the 16 million Americans in uniform, and you would become one of them. But at this point, for a couple years, you're not in uniform, but you're doing something that's vital to the war effort. And so many other wars. Women were, older men who weren't young enough to serve, they were doing the same thing. Did you feel like you were doing something important, something that was helping?
I felt I was adding to it, and I did. And, you know, in retrospect, I was doing more for the war effort as a ship fitter and repairing the ships and doing whatever we were doing. But then my number came up, and so then I became an aviation radioman and operation in PBYs, and then the war was over, so I didn't see the war zones.
Well, we'll talk about that. What else about your time at Mare Island? What else did you see there or experience there that stands out in your memory?
Yeah, they do their best to camouflage. Back in those days, they did the best to camouflage the facility. Then they'd put these balloons up to show you where they were.
A little bit of a contradiction?
Yeah, it's a little contradiction. The object was the cables from those balloons, would, if anybody, you know, the dive bomber or something would come in, they'd run into the cables and come out. But why go to the trouble of camouflaging and then put the barrage balloons up to show you where it was?
X marks the spot, yeah. And Mare Island was a pretty busy place then. And you can go there now. They have a museum there, and they still have that famous chapel with the Tiffany windows and all that in the East Bay. But back then, there was a whole lot of activity there.
We were real, real busy. Three shifts, and it was the first time I'd ever worked an eight-hour day. So as a ship fitter, I had a progress report on all the projects I was working on, and I'd have to write where each one was, and so the next shifts were good. And they kept it up so we could keep everything moving slowly. So.
And I think, you know, those of us who didn't live through World War II, I think we have a hard time understanding how ever-present that situation was. When you would, you know, see the newspaper headline or hear something on the radio about a battle in the Pacific or in Europe or wherever, was there a concern that America and its allies might not win this war?
Well, no, we had every faith that we were going to win. We didn't have a defeatist attitude. We're going to win, so we finally did. Man, it was because of the attitude of everybody. I mean, you wanted to contribute to the war effort. Even those who wanted to draft, dodge the draft, they were working in the war effort. Even they were putting out the product to finally enable our guys to win.
Win they would. Time for our first break, but much more to come with 96-year-old Lewis Wagoner. If you live in California, you've likely benefited from some of his engineering expertise, and you didn't even realize it. And we're also hear how an ill-fated camping trip led to a prolific career in sailboat racing. Hear that part of the story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Some people see the challenge and say, send me. Some hear, it can't be done,
and say, "I'll do it." Some choose to stand for something bigger than us all. If you're ready to step forward and do your part, then you might be ready to become a soldier in the U.S. Army. It's a diverse team that works together, trains hard, and adapts every day to be ready for anything that comes next. The U.S. Army turns soldiers into leaders capable of split-second decisions, extreme focus, and maximum endurance. These warriors lead their squads on missions armed with more than good intentions. They inspire their fellow soldiers to do better on and off the battlefield, making the Army a lethal and ready force. U.S. Army soldiers blaze a trail that leads to freedom. Do you have what it takes? Find your place on the team. Contact your local Army recruiter or visit goarmy.com/warriors.